they do good things, and then we just hope that the next ruler also does good things. And if they ever don't, then it becomes a problem. The whole point behind like democracy and wanting to distribute power more evenly amongst people is to avoid that kind of situation in the first place, and to let people have a say in the things that affect their lives.
There's a highlight from a new episode of Seriously Wrong. Find new episodes of the internationally acclaimed utopian leftist comedy show at seriouslywrong.com, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Since launching in May 2023, Perspectives, the Broadbent Institute's Journal of Political Economy and Social Democracy, has brought left-wing thought and inquiry into public debates and policy for building a more just and equitable Canada. On this excerpt from a new episode of segment Social Democrats of the North, host Dave McGrain introduces the Catholic roots of Quebec's social democratic tradition in an episode exploring the history of L'École Sociale Populaire. Now, here's the show.
Hi, and welcome to episode 11 of season 1 of Social Democrats of the North, presented by the Broadbent Institute's Perspectives Journal podcast series. I'm your host, Dave McGrain, a professor of political science at St. Thomas More College at the University of Saskatchewan, and a member of the Perspectives Journal editorial committee. From Confederation to the Quiet Revolution, Social Democrats of the North takes you on a journey through history to discover the lives and ideas of the leaders who have shaped Canadian social democracy. It looks at the influence of social democracy on Canadian history and draws lessons for our activism today from social democracy's past. In the last episode, I looked at Ernest and Harold Winch, two of the pioneers of social democracy in British Columbia. In this episode, I want to examine the roots of social democracy in Quebec and argue that they are deeper than you may think and more homegrown than you may think. If you learned Canadian political history in the usual way, you were probably taught that social democracy and left-wing thinking in Quebec emerged as a reaction against the Catholic Church in the 1960s. The standard story is that the left in Quebec comes out of the Quiet Revolution. It comes out of the 1960s when Quebec experienced a large amount of secularization and there was a decline in the political power of the Catholic Church. But I want to argue that this story neglects something crucial. Before Quebec had a social democratic party, before it had a modern welfare state, and before it became secularized, there was a Catholic social movement that was criticizing capitalism and calling for state intervention in the economy. And the most important expression of that Catholic social movement was the École Sociale Populaire, or what I'll be calling the ESP. It represents the Catholic roots of social democracy in Quebec, and its influence on Quebec politics is much more considerable than most people recognize. The École Sociale Populaire was founded in Montreal in 1911 by Jesuit Catholic priests, most notably Joseph Papin Archambault. Montreal in 1911 was an industrial city, and for Francophone workers, it was a brutal one to work in and live in. As these Catholic priests walked around Montreal's Francophone working-class neighborhoods, they saw injustice everywhere. They saw overcrowded housing with families with 10 children living in tiny apartments. They saw men crippled by factory accidents begging on the street. They saw mothers sending their young sons and daughters off to do child labor in massive factories. All the while, the rich businessmen of Montreal's West End got drunk on expensive champagne and ate caviar. These priests trembled with anger at what they saw. But what could they do? Where could they look for a set of ideas to solve the problem that they were encountering? In fact, they were in a tricky situation. They were forbidden by a papal decree to become directly involved in politics by running for office or starting their own political party. And they were humble parish priests, not high-ranking bishops who could influence powerful politicians and businessmen. They came up with a unique solution. They would focus on adult education. They would organize conferences, create study circles, and publish pamphlets to teach the citizens of Quebec about the suffering of the working class and talk about ways to end it. They hoped that political parties and politicians would eventually adopt their ideas when they became popular enough. These priests were bold in what they were proposing. After all, they had no real allies in the political parties that controlled Quebec politics. And their bosses, the bishops of Quebec, generally frowned upon local priests getting too involved in politics. It wasn't that the bishops thought that the Catholic Church shouldn't be involved in politics. It definitely should. Rather, the bishops saw it as their job to direct how the Catholic Church should be involved in politics. Well, the priests would essentially echo whatever the bishops said. And the Catholic Church in Quebec and its bishops weren't exactly known at the time for their critiques of capitalism. Instead of providing these priests with ideas on how to criticize capitalism, the Quebec bishops and most of the hierarchy in the Catholic Church defended the economic order and political order that existed in Quebec. There was a very real possibility that Quebec's bishops would actually publicly denounce any criticisms of capitalism made by Archambault and the ESP. In spite of all these risks, these priests committed themselves to this new organization like sailors setting out into stormy seas. For the first 20 years of their existence, it would be fair to say that the ESP organized in a quiet, methodical, and deliberate manner. It started by reading and engaging with social democratic ideas from outside of Quebec. Archambault and other members of the ESP read about Christian socialism in English Canada, the ideas of trade unions in the United States, and the philosophy of the Labour Party in Great Britain. They also read all about social democratic ideas that were emerging in Francophone European countries like France and Belgium. But none of these philosophies seemed to fit the situation as they saw in Quebec. Applying these ideas to Quebec was like trying to fit a round peg into a square hole. So the ESP decided to make their own homegrown version of social democracy that was tailored to the unique circumstances of Quebec. They called this version of social democracy Catholic social teaching, relying on certain biblical passages and the writings of popes like Pope Leo XIII, the ESP suggested that there are moral limits on property rights. They asked, if property rights of large businessmen were defended to the point of creating suffering for the working class, wasn't this an immoral situation? After all, Jesus taught us to love our brother. And Jesus preached that it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter the kingdom of God. The ESP slowly began to formulate Catholic positions on just wages for workers and on workers' rights. And they began to apply these Catholic positions to understanding the structures of Quebec's economy. They started to defend the position that the poor are not poor due to their moral failings or their lack of work ethic. The moral failing is not with the poor, they said. The moral failing is with the capitalist system itself that exploits the poor to make greedy businessmen rich beyond all reasonable limits. These ideas were gradually introduced into Quebec political discourse by the ESP. The ESP understood that controversial ideas need to be introduced slowly, first in whispers, then in print, and only later loudly in public settings. But the ESP did not just create new ideas about Catholic social teaching during this formative period of its history. It also created new organizations and new institutional frameworks. It helped to found and expand the Catholic unions that represent Francophone workers in Quebec. The ESP began to run conferences called the Semaine Sociale du Canada. The goal of these conferences was to train a group of activists that would go out into Quebec society and work for the implementation of Catholic social teaching. The leaders of the ESP thought that this group of activists could become influential in various organizations and could use that influence to reduce the poverty of the Francophone working class. By the end of the 1920s, the ESP had built up an impressive network of activists who shared its way of thinking. More importantly, it had established a defensible Catholic critique of the economic injustices inherent in Quebec's economy. It had Catholicized social democracy and had formulated social democratic ideas that were applicable to the unique situation of Quebec. It had developed a homegrown version of social democracy made by Quebecers for Quebecers. Then something happened that no one was expecting. In 1929, stock markets around the world crashed and Quebec was plunged into a deep economic recession. People who had been skeptical about what the ESP had been saying all of a sudden started to pay attention to them. The activists that the ESP had trained immediately became more influential in their organizations. And more Francophone workers sought to join the Catholic unions that the ESP had created. The ESP even got a helping hand from Rome. In 1931, Pope Pius XI wrote a papal letter that echoed many of the things that the ESP had been saying for a number of years. This letter explicitly condemned how capitalism concentrates too much wealth in the hands of a small number of rich capitalists, and it called for governments to directly intervene in the economy to create greater social and economic equality. Under the leadership of Archambault, the ESP kicked its activity into high gear. Archambault and his Jesuit colleagues stayed up late into the night writing pamphlets about the injustices of capitalism. And by day, they organized study circles and public events to spread their ideas far and wide. They believed that if enough Francophone workers and enough members of the Francophone middle class could be educated about Catholic social teaching, then Quebec could be transformed into a new and more just society. It was exhausting and exhilarating work. These priests were doing the labor of sociologists, economists, and political organizers all at once, while being careful not to say anything that would anger the bishops who were their bosses. In 1933, at the height of the Great Depression, the ESP published Le Programme de Restauration Sociale, or the Programme of Social Restoration, as it would be called in English, and the program struck like a lightning bolt in Quebec politics. Everybody was talking about it. The ESP had finally attained the level of influence that it hoped that it could achieve when it was founded 20 years ago. I want to spend some time describing the Programme of Social Restoration for a couple of reasons. First, it provides a really good summary of the ideas of the ESP and its Catholic social teaching. Second, it is a very important document in Quebec history. It is like the Quebec version of the Regina Manifesto, the CCF's founding document that I described in the episode on the League for Social Reconstruction. The program starts off by critiquing the Quebec economic system from a Catholic point of view. The ESP condemns the terrible exploitation of farmers, fishermen, and workers by large monopolies whose owners do not care about others in society and only think of themselves. It points out the very un-Catholic way that owners of monopoly push up prices for consumers while pushing down the wages that they pay their workers. Worse yet, the owners of these large businesses encourage unethical corruption by giving donations to political parties in exchange for these parties making laws that protected their monopolies. However, for the ESP, the role of Catholics is not to kneel and pray while ignoring that there's poverty and misery right outside the doors of their church. No, Catholics must actively try to change the politics of their society. The ESP points to Catholic unions and Catholic cooperatives as ways to do this. Catholic unions would give workers more control over their workplace and protect them from unfair labor practices. Catholic cooperatives would give fishermen and farmers control over the price at which they sold their products. Over time, these cooperatives could gradually replace the privately owned monopolies and create a more fair Quebec economy for all citizens. It is here that we can see a difference between the ESP and Social Democrats in English Canada. There is much more of an element of mutual self-help in the ideas of the ESP. That is, people coming together to help themselves instead of relying on the government. I would argue that the large role played by cooperatives and unions in the ideas of the ESP shows how they adapted social democracy to the strong anti-communism, anti-statism in Quebec Catholicism in the 1930s. Quebec Catholics feared that giving too much power to the government was the start of a slippery slope towards a communist regime that would outlaw the freedom of religion that Catholics needed to practice. For the ESP, the great thing about cooperatives and unions is that they allow some control of economic institutions by average citizens, but they do not necessarily increase the power of government because both unions and cooperatives are under the democratic control of their members. Nonetheless, the ESP still saw a role for government to play in the economy. The Program of Social Restoration called for government ownership of public utilities that are natural monopolies. Here is where something that Quebec is still famous for comes into their thinking: hydroelectricity. The ESP justified the nationalization of hydroelectricity in Quebec through stating the following. I'll say it in French and then in English. They said that the exploitation de nos richesses hydrauliques au profit de la collectif est nécessaire. In English, the extraction of our natural electrical riches for the profit of the collective is necessary. The ESP also called on the Quebec provincial government to institute a minimum wage for all workers. It should be noted that there's definitely an element of sexism in the thinking of the SP about the minimum wage, and that sexism is directly related to Quebec's situation of being a linguistic minority in Canada. In fact, the ESP called the minimum wage a salaire familial, or a family salary, and the ESP argued that a high family salary was necessary to ensure that Francophone women could stay at home and raise large families to guarantee the survival of the French-speaking Quebecois nation. In the Program for Social Restoration, there is also a strong emphasis on governments expanding the availability of agricultural land for urban workers to take over, an idea that's not found in social democratic documents from English Canada during this time period.
There's a highlight from a recent episode of the Perspectives podcast. Find out more at perspectivesjournal.ca, at broadbentinstitute.ca, and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase in your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. And finally, for more than four decades, Red Eye presents a progressive take on current events, produced by an independent media collective at Vancouver Co-op Radio. On the segment from a recent episode, the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, Andrew Longhurst, explains how public health care advocates are protesting in response to Alberta's new two-tier health care law, allowing doctors to practice in both the public and private system. Now, here's the show.
I'm Jane Williams. This is the Red Eye Podcast. You can hear our live broadcast on Saturday mornings from 10 till noon at 100.5 FM in the Lower Mainland. On the podcast today, Alberta's Bill 11 leaves the door open for foreign companies to move into Canada's public healthcare system and be protected by trade agreements. Andrew Longhurst explains how. On March 16th, public health care advocates across the country took part in rallies and news conferences in response to Alberta's new two-tier health care law, which allows doctors to practice in both the public and the private system. People are calling on the federal government to enforce the Canada Health Act and stop the expansion of private for-profit services. In early February, we spoke with researcher Andrew Longhurst about the threat that Bill 11 poses to universal access to health care. He warned that Alberta's new law also opens the door to U.S. companies selling private health insurance for basic care. We wanted to explore this issue further with him, so we've contacted him again today. Andrew Longhurst is a researcher with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and he joins me today from the Sunshine Coast. Hello, Andrew. Thanks for joining us again.
Hi, Jane.
Now, you and Stuart True wrote a recent report for the CCPA that focuses on the threat from trade and investment agreements. And I was surprised to read that Canada is signatory to over 100 trade and investment treaties. What did those agreements cover, generally speaking?
Yeah, so Canada is party to many agreements, and these tend to cover goods, as well as services, intellectual property, really runs across different sectors. So it's these trade agreements are quite extensive. And, you know, we tend to talk about a few of them more commonly, like the Canada-US-Mexico Agreement, CUSMA, which is the new NAFTA. But there's also others like the General Agreement on Trade and Services with the WTO. So there's a number of them. And there's also lots of agreements that are bilateral between Canada and other countries.
And I understand that they guarantee foreign private service firms sort of a broad market access and national treatment in Canada.
Yeah, that's right. So many of the agreements include rights that firms need to be treated the same way that domestic firms are treated. And there are exceptions to that, and those are important when we talk about healthcare and publicly funded social services. In the case of the General Agreement on Trade and Services. This excludes services that are provided in the what's called the exercise of governmental authority. And so anything that's provided on a non-commercial basis or not in competition with other service providers is kind of exempted or excluded. And that's really important because it helps establish that there are public services like healthcare that need to not be open to trade liberalization.
So public healthcare is exempted because it's run by government. It isn't a business.
That's right.
So what's the impact of Alberta's two-tier reforms on that?
Well, what this legislation does is it really erases the boundary between public healthcare and private healthcare or private payment for healthcare. And as we see the Alberta government introduce legislation that will encourage private health insurance for doctor and hospital services that are covered under the Canada Health Act, it opens the door for private health insurers and other for-profit healthcare firms to move into this space. And that when we blur or we remove the boundary between that distinction, we start to lose what is in, for example, the General Agreement on Trade and Services, or GATS, that distinction of in the exercise of governmental authority. And so the more that we lose the definition and the characteristic of public health care in this country being not up for sale or investment, we really start to lose those protections that exist under some of those existing trade agreements like GATS.
How could foreign for-profit healthcare providers gain a foothold in the healthcare market here?
Yeah, there's a number of ways. The first is that these foreign, they could be U.S. or foreign providers, for-profits, could be U.S. hospital chains, for example. They could seek entry into provincial health systems by bidding on contracts for publicly funded outsourced surgeries, diagnostics. We already have two U.S. firms that are involved in delivering community-based lab services. And so they already have a foothold in that sector. So the ability for them to bid on contract, we see increasingly provinces outsourcing or using public funds to pay private for-profit firms to deliver publicly funded services. So that's one avenue. The second avenue for foreign and U.S. interests to enter the Canadian market is by offering private health insurance products for medically necessary doctor and hospital services that are already covered under the Canada Health Act. The door is now open wide for that with Alberta's two-tier legislation.
You write that Alberta Premier Danielle Smith has already said that she sees government leasing health facilities to third-party operators.
That's right. There was a private United Conservative Party event that was reported quite widely in the press, and she stated that she sees the future of healthcare delivery in Alberta, where the Alberta government is leasing publicly owned, ostensibly hospital facilities and other healthcare facilities to third-party operators. And through that, we can assume that these are private for-profit providers. And, you know, this could very likely be the way that U.S. or foreign corporations expand and gain that foothold into the provincial health system. And by that pathway into Canada by way of Alberta is a way that they will have protections under international trade agreements that make it very difficult for us to regulate them and for us to ultimately get them out of the country should the Alberta government want to do that, and risks them also moving into other markets across the country.
You mentioned a couple of U.S. corporations already involved in the healthcare sphere in Canada. Would we be familiar with those names?
Yeah, so I think folks in BC will be very aware of Life Labs, which is owned by a New Jersey publicly traded company called Quest. And then there's also DynaCare, which has more of a presence in other parts of the country. It's owned by a North Carolina company called LabCorp of America. And then there's another company that's involved in blood collection and paid plasma collection, and that's called Grifols, and it's received quite a bit of attention in recent days following two deaths of individuals who donated on a paid basis plasma in their clinics in Manitoba. So, you know, we already have U.S. and international firms invested and entrenched in this country, and I think it would be a big mistake to see more involvement.
When you talk about the possibility of private health insurance products being offered for medically necessary doctor or hospital services that are insured under the Canada Health Act, how could that happen? How could that start to happen?
Well, what the legislation in Alberta does is it allows for a private health insurance market for those services that are right now we expect to go to the doctor's office, to go to the hospital, and we don't walk away with a bill for tens of thousands of dollars. Under Alberta's Bill 11, the legislation that has created two-tier healthcare in that province, that all changes. And so what we are anticipating and kind of the direction of travel in Alberta is that insurance companies would likely start to target their insurance products at large employers and public sector unions, where there's the largest market to begin with. And keeping in mind that in this country, we already have a very significant health insurance market for extended health benefits. These are employer-sponsored plans. And again, the market within the public sector for public sector employers and unions is quite significant. About two-thirds or so of Canadians already have extended health care through their employer. And so adding private coverage for workers to obtain faster access, queue jumping insurance for elective surgeries and diagnostics, for example, would be, I think, the way that this market will be built. And so it is foreseeable that those private health insurance companies would try to gain a foothold through that first, and then to probably start selling individual insurance products to individuals who are not covered under a large public sector collective agreement, and selling those private insurance products to individuals who don't have that employer-sponsored private health insurance.
You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode has been brought to you by Unrated. Learn more about Canada's community of more than 30 progressive publishers. Get all your independent Canadian journalism, including news, videos, and podcasts, in one place at unrated.ca. On Blue Sky and Instagram for updates on new episodes, and subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 89 socially and politically progressive podcasts. Again, if you're in Montreal, don't miss Harbinger Soapbox Volume 7, a live podcast recording titled Sports Washing and Imperialism at Bar Milton Park Co-op on Thursday, April 16th from 6 to 9 p.m. with the end of sport, a beep to please, Palestinian youth movement, and more. It'll be a great night, so hopefully see you there. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now, back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
We are diverse, independent, and yours. CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
This is BirdNote. I'm Nick Byard, BirdNote's Executive Director. And this week, we're asking you to support the show at birdnote.org. When you fill your bird feeder, all things considered, it's a small part of your whole day, but it means a lot to the birds that visit your yard. You don't have to buy expensive binoculars or travel to faraway lands to be a birder. You can enjoy birds wherever you are. And you don't have to break the bank to support BirdNote. Make a gift of any amount today at birdnote.org to keep this show on the air for years to come. Even $5 a month helps us create the stories that connect you to the joy of birds and nature. Did you know that BirdNote is an independent nonprofit? We provide our daily shows for free to all public radio stations, including this one, regardless of size or location. The vast majority of BirdNote's funding comes from listeners like you. It only takes a few minutes to support the show and make a big difference for birds. Donate for the first time or renew your support today at birdnote.org. Thank you for listening, and thank you for making BirdNote possible. I'm Nick Byard.